Hi, this is Damon Pastolka, host of The Faces of Business, where I talk with interesting people sharing life and business experiences to entertain, engage, build community, and provide information to help others succeed. If you're interested in learning more about one of our guests or how we are helping business owners generate wealth and build businesses they can sell or succeed at Exit Your Way, you can find more information on our website, exityourway.com. Or by contacting me directly, Damon@exityourway.com. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Welcome once again to The Faces of Business. I am your host, Damon Pastolka, and I am so excited today for our guest. We have Carrie Jacobs-Crovetto here with us today. We're talking about putting your soul back into your work. Carrie, thanks for being here today.
Oh my gosh, Damon. I'm so excited. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, when we got introduced and I started doing a little bit of research on you, I thought this is going to be a lot of fun because someone that has spent the time, had the career you have had, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but then someone that is as adventurous, I would say, that has gone to, I believe, at time of publishing of what I saw, 17 Burning Man events.
Oh, that's hilarious. I always forget that they put that in my bio. Yes, I have been long ago. I stopped some years ago, but I was an early kind of, an OG in the Burning Man world.
Yeah, I just think of that because every time I had friends that have gone and I'm like, I do not like dust. I do not like mud. So...
I have to say what overcomes the dust and the mud as overcomes the dust and the mud in life is the experiences that you have there with the art and the people, right? Yeah. So I'm sure this will somehow infiltrate our conversation.
It'll come around, but that's something. But Carrie, we always like to start out with our guests kind of giving a background about where you came from, because you've done some really incredible things with some big, big names, done a lot of things like that. And then you made a transition in your career, but let's just kind of understand where you started from and kind of your transition, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So I started off in the ad agency world. So I did about 15 years plus in ad agencies all over the world. I lived in London and New York and LA and San Francisco, right here where I am today. And then when I was 39, I had what I would call my first sort of big midlife crisis, which is, I remember the moment so distinctly. I remember the feeling in my body, looking down at my hands, sitting outside of a room about to go into a meeting and asking myself this question, which was, am I really happy? And what is happiness, right? And I had, I'd become a vice president really young. I think I was 31 when I became a vice president, and I'd excelled, much faster than I'd planned to. And here I was in this moment, sitting outside this meeting room, wondering, am I really happy? And I decided that I didn't know the answer to that question. And so I sold my condo, which was 6 blocks from the beach in Santa Monica. I sold about 50% of my stuff. I ended a relationship I'd been in for like 2 years, and I took off and traveled for about a year and a half total. And came back and had a mighty change, which we can talk about. And then since then, I've had another mighty change.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you were sitting there, I mean, how long had you been thinking about, I don't like this, I'm happy, I love what I'm doing? I mean, because in my world, it's happened to me before where you just go, one day good, next day not so good. And then finally it just hits and you go, I'm just done with this. But how was it for you getting up to that point?
I will tell you, when I was 15 years old, I took a philosophy course in high school and I read a Russian philosopher, Tolstoy, and I read Kafka. And there was a story called The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Do you know that? Have you heard of this story at all?
Heard of it, yeah.
Right. So the story is about a guy who's been pretty successful. And he goes to the doctor one day, you know, whistling on his way, thinking he's having a checkup. And he's told, you have 3 weeks to live. And in that 3 weeks, I think this was the time, I'm hearkening back many years ago now, but it was like some set time to live. And in that time, he just had to lay in bed and think about his life. And he had all this regret because he had put so much time and energy into making money and only making money that he forgot about everything else. And at 15, I remember saying, I'm never going to be that person. And then there would be these moments in my life, you know, you just kind of do the do, right? You go to college, you get the job, you do all the things you're supposed to do. And there would be these little moments that would, I call them sacred pauses, these sort of sacred pauses that would pop in and out where I would ask myself, like, is this what I'm really supposed to be doing? Am I happy? You know, am I going down this track? Or if I were told I had 3 weeks to live today, would I feel like I had fulfilled the full palette of my life? And there were often times when I just felt this like little pain, but then it would be like, oh my God, I had a client call or whatever I had to do. Yeah. I had to go shoot some creative and I would be back at it. And I never really gave myself very long to pause. I will say that in around 1998, when it was super uncool to go on meditation retreats and people thought I was super weird, I did my first meditation retreat. So by the time I had come up against this moment when I was 39, I had certainly had, you know, enough reflection time, but a lot of that time in meditation was just sort of trying to figure out, like, how do you sit for 11 hours? How do you get through? I mean, it takes sometimes years to be able to sit for that long. And my big question then was like, what am I even sitting for? Like, what am I after here? What is enlightenment? So these sort of two questions kept converging, right? Like, where is enlightenment and where am I in my life and where am I in my career, until I hit that sort of 39-year-old moment where I took off and traveled.
Wow. That's, I mean, that, what you're, it's a big step. What you did, a big step. I mean, you think about it. That age, I mean, it's still young, still in that, you know, everybody thinks we should be in there driving hard doing that. And you said, listen, I'm going to stop and I'm going to take this sacred pause, but it's going to be a long sacred pause to be able to really think about this.
That's right. And it was, you know, it was before Eat, Pray, Love came out, right? So this was not something that, you know, I think her book came out like 3 weeks after my return.
Okay.
So I left and I had two big questions when I left. I had written them down in a journal. The first question was, you know, what is my path? Like, what am I here for? Right? Sort of that purpose question that kind of plagues many of us at some moments of our life. And then the second question was, what is the nature of romantic love? Okay. Two very big questions.
Yeah.
So I think at that point I'd been working most of my life. I was single. I was 39, about to turn 40, wondering, okay, I didn't have kids. I didn't do the things that maybe most of the people around me were doing. And I had this big giant pause.
Wow. I think we should just tell you, that in for a minute.
I can tell you, my dad, right, who was like a finance guy, was like, you're doing what? I'm going to Africa, Dad. I'm going to go to the Himalayas, Dad. I'm going to go sit in Burma. You know, to my father, this sounded absolutely insane. My dad had never traveled outside the country. We're Lebanese by nationality. And once they got here, I don't think he ever left.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So let's talk about that. So you're on this 18-month journey trying to at least get better clarity on these two questions. What am I here for? What is the nature of true love? So did you have some, like, I'm going to go here because I want to do this. I want to go there because I want to experience that. So you kind of had some rhyme or reason to this 18 months or
I did. I mean, my goal was to go around, like, to make it around the world. Like, that was sort of my goal. Like, if I could, you know, not every single continent, but if I could at least touch, you know, sort of do around the world. But I will say, I was traveling as a single woman. That wasn't happening much, you know, yet in the year, sort of 2004, 2005. I wanted to go to places that felt otherworldly, like Africa. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to a place where I could experience, like I got to, you know, experience the Maasai warrior and camp with them. I camped with them. I also wanted to go to India because at that point I had been practicing meditation. And, you know, all good meditators who are really serious at some point up until that time had to go to India.
Yeah.
It really wasn't here, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to see the Dalai Lama, and I wanted to see the Ganga River, and I, you know, I wanted to really soak in, you know, talk about, you know, what I can tell you now in retrospect is you can go to Africa and you can still feel the West in Africa, right? They listen to Western music, you know, even in the middle of the Serengeti, right? You go to India at that time and everything is Bollywood all the time. Like there's nothing in there that's really permeating from America. So it felt like another planet at the time.
Yeah. Wow. So as you're doing that trip, what were some of the things that, I mean, cause this, was this one of your first times on an extended out of the country thing like this, or is this pretty frequent up to that point?
I've been out of the country often, mostly for work. And I had done some, you know, some fun travel, but nothing like this. Nothing like a year and a half where you're like, I started off with a backpack, but I will confess that about 3 weeks into the trip, I looked around at all the young kids. I was like staying in hostels. I mean, this wasn't fancy. And they all have rolly bags. I'm like, what am I doing? Like, it's the new thing is not to backpack through the world. It's really rolly bag through the world. So I ditched that and got myself a really easy rolling bag. But I will say there were three poignant moments that to this day kind of reshaped how I think about things. You want to hear them?
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Okay. So my moment one was that I was in Europe and I had been alone for many days. Like I'd been traveling alone and I would certainly talk to people here and there, but I was mostly alone. And I began to have this super visceral experience of being my age through all of my ages. In other words, I was 39, but I remember walking the streets of Italy and thinking, wow, I really am connecting with me who was 5 and me who was 7 and me who was 9. And because I had no social construct around me and there was no social media at the time, email was barely happening. Mm-hmm. You had to go to an internet cafe.
Yeah.
What became really clear to me was that when all of my baggage of life was stripped away, all my identities were stripped away, right? The identity of daughter, of sister, of vice president, of friend, a Burning Man person, when all of it was gone and it was just me with me, I instantly knew who I was again.
Wow.
That was one.
That had to be something. Oh yeah. We have to come back to that. So what was number two then? You stripped everything away and you knew who you were again.
Who I was again. And by the way, I will caveat all this because the question might come up. You don't have to go away to do any of this, but it did help. Number two, this was kind of a big one. So when I had left, you know, Bush was president. We were, you know, still healing from 9/11. There was a lot of, you know, sort of anti-Muslim, like just sort of narrative out there in the world. And I think I traveled through countries that large, diverse populations of all kinds, right? Muslim included. We don't see that as, now we're starting to, but certainly back then we weren't seeing that as much in the US. And I got on a plane and I sat down one day, it was a United Emirates flight. And I had this absolutely deep exchange with a soldier from Saudi at the time, who, you know, accidentally fell asleep on my shoulder during this flight. Like, he accidentally just flopped over on my shoulder. We hadn't talked, and he woke up, and there we are. I'm the only American on this flight at the time. And we had this beautiful exchange, and I thought, wow, you know, I'm not sure things are totally what I think. You know, I was sort of this hippie at the time. I was a little bit of this warrior princess, like, I'm going to change the world. And then second to that, I had another moment when I was in Amsterdam, where I was sitting up on a hill, and I had been reading a lot about all the artists and the wars that had been happening in Europe. And I just had this visceral sense of, again, this sort of like, things have always been the way they are, and they maybe are never going to change. Like, you don't have to change the world. You don't have to work so hard to change the world. And here's what came to me. You just have to hold down the side of love. Like, if you just do that side, that's enough.
Just hold down the side of love. Because you're right. I mean, when you look back through history, you look back through the turmoils and all the things, we keep repeating ourselves in a lot of respects. But if you worry about love, that's a powerful force for good and for living happier, I think. Yeah,
absolutely. And it solves so many problems at one time, right? It's like, even when we're disagreeing, even when we feel like we're in sort of a dualistic handcuff of right and wrong, if we're coming from that place of holding down the side of love, you can get to an answer. Like, it just came to me. And I'll tell you, it really did shape that, the answers to that second question of what is the nature of romantic love, which we'll get to. Then the third thing, which is, it all kind of interrelates here, is, you know, I'll sidestep from it. You know, I've never told this story just like this, and I'm realizing now how it all comes together. And I'm just feeling a great deal of gratitude for this in this moment.
Awesome.
So the third thing that I learned is, I sat for 2 months. I was in India for about 3.5-4 months total. And of that time, the majority was spent in silence, studying with a Tibetan teacher. And I would take silence at about 9 or 10 in the morning, and I would stay silent until around 7 or 8 at night. And this kind of moment that I'd had when I was in Italy, where I realized I'd sort of, who I was is who I'd always been, and I was sort of ageless. Like, there's a part of me that was ageless.
Mm-hmm.
That part of me that was timeless and ageless grew in strength. And it was as if any job that I took, any person that I dated, any path that I made, any way I went was the right way if I stayed in this place of kind of limitlessness, of timelessness, of knowing that the person who is me has a timeless energy about it, and that timeless energy is actually the same exact timeless energy that exists in you. That's a little esoteric.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really deep learning, right? But if you break it down into its simplest form, I ask people, and I'll ask you this, Damon, when do you recall having your very first memory? Like, how old were you? Like, the very first, even if it's hazy and you're like, oh, I kind of remember, how old were you?
You know, the early years, like 5-7 years old, something like that.
Five? Do you remember a little bit of what the memory was?
Yeah, I can remember playing with my parents.
Yeah, you're playing.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, at five, we don't really have the cognitive language ability yet to have tracked that memory into language. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what tracked that is the same thing that's tracking you today.
Yeah. That part, like you say, that's ageless and timeless.
The part that's ageless and timeless.
I was just reading about this last week, so it's weird.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, that's where freedom, freedom, you just find freedom, right? Because if you stay, and that's the difference, you know, in sort of meditation terms, when we get really bound to our ego or to the story of who we are and what we're doing, that's where suffering happens. That's where it can feel like, oh my God, what is this life we're living?
Yeah.
If we're staying in connection with this other part of us, then it's pretty hard to not find joy in whatever we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Even in sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Even in grief, right? There's some element of just bold heart opening that happens. So yeah. That's what I found. And then I had to come back home to the United States.
Well, this is incredible. We're going to continue on. This is, wow. Thank you. That's what we'll start with that. We're going to say thank you there. And we're going to move on a little bit because you then came back.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that because you're teaching at Stanford. You've got some great stuff going on there. Let's continue on.
Yeah. So I came back and it took me a minute. And I basically ended up working in mostly in two areas in sustainability. And I was focused on renewable energy, especially after living in places like India and Africa, where they don't have energy that's consistent mm-hmm. like ours, and the energy would just go off and on at any time. And I ended up working in two solar startups and then transitioned. That kind of put me into the startup world. And after that, I did three more startups. So I did five startups total, where I led marketing and ended up being a CMO. And, you know, the big change for me, though, coming out of that was, and I talk about this with my clients, is there was a switch that happened. And that switch was the switch of from doing to being.
Nice.
Right? And if I focused so much on productivity, I would just continue to wear my soul down to the ground, right? How much can I produce? How much can I not get fired, right? If I moved into a focus on being, how was I showing up? How was I landing? I'm a passionate, direct, and outgoing woman. Doesn't always work so well with everybody, right? If I could focus on that, it was and stay with this sort of timeless piece of myself, mm-hmm. which is presence, really, if we want to name it, it's presence. If I could stay present in every moment to my life, then I found that the satisfaction, it didn't really matter what I was doing. And then it was crazy because that was just begetting more and more success. Like the more I did that, the more success it was begetting. And so in 2020, when the pandemic hit, I was working for a Y Combinator startup called Torch, which is still out there. I was the CMO. Like many startups at the time, we had to, you know, crank down spending, and there wasn't mm-hmm. a lot of money for marketing. And the CEO said, hey, you've been coaching me. You've done a pretty good job. Do you want to become a coach? And I said, as a matter of fact, I do. And without really thinking of it, again, like super present moment, I just changed my entire career. And so for the last 4 years, I've been coaching. For the last 2.5 of that, I've been facilitating a course at Stanford called Interpersonal Dynamics, which is about the being side of leadership and of work. And that leads me to present day.
Yeah. So one of the things that you talked about, and I don't know where it was, I could pull it up here because I've got all your stuff up here, but it was about, you know, you've really, what you were talking about in your career at the end there before you started coaching, when you're coaching people now, and you've got these type A people that are coming to you, what are some of the common things that you see with them right away that you saw in yourself that you go, ha, we're going to have some fun with this?
I love those people, by the way. They're my favorites. The more type A, the better. Two things. The more type A and the person who says, you know, I can't meditate because my mind just keeps thinking, as if their mind is any different than any mind. Yeah. The mind's job is to think, right?
Yeah.
So I think the commonalities are that typically we're living in a very disembodied state, right? So we're living, you know, 10 to 15 to 25 feet out in front of ourselves most of the day. You know, you and I talked a little bit before we came on air, and you know, it seems like you've found out that just by being in nature and being present with nature through your own walks, that you can look at a tree and become very embodied. You can sense and feel and take it in, right? Most of us are literally walking. If you imagine your eyes, you're posted about 10, 15, 20 feet in front of yourself. And then you add, you know, cell phones in, and now we've got this, like, you know, 2 foot, 1 foot in front of ourselves. So we're living like from here to here all the time. So that's the first thing I'll usually see. And I just have an ability at this point to see when somebody is either in their body or out of their body.
Yeah.
And if I'm able to actually talk to them, or if I'm just talking to the spin in their brain.
I've never heard it said like that, but you can tell when you're talking to people like that, because there's just so much going on that you're really not getting anywhere.
You're not getting anywhere. And it's funny because most people, it's spin talking to spin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's why, to come back to this question of soul, putting soul back into your work, we're so exhausted from spin talking to spin that we feel completely dissatisfied inside. Because the spin is just, it's nothing, it's vaporware. Our thoughts are vaporware. Our baloney is vapor, it's vaporware.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we become really disenchanted and sad and disconnected and lonely and frustrated and unseen and unfelt, right? Because our bodies aren't actually with us in the experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. Incredible. So as you're talking to these people and they think you're absolutely crazy because they're never going to help them. I mean, because I can just see it.
I may not go right into it, by the way. I may talk about operating models for the first three sessions, right? Let's talk about your operating model. Right? But
yeah, but still, these people are going, yeah, I hope you can help, but you know, I've tried a lot, blah, 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 blah. So what are some of the things that if these people start to really, A, think about it deeply enough to make a change and then start making that change, what are some of the little things that they're going to see to change? So if someone's listening today and they go, listen, I'm done. I want to try something else. What are some of the little changes that they're going to see in their life, in their mind, and whatever, that's going to go, you might be on the right track?
Yeah. So I would say if they're feeling distressed, I'm done, stressed. Stress is a big one, right? Where it's just, you're in the spin, you're in the spin, you're in the spin. There's so much fear and pressure today. Oh my goodness, right? The first thing I will practice with them is putting them back in touch with a different place of resourcing, so that they're not trying to resource from this place of spinning out in the mind, but they're actually resourcing from their neurobiology, from their body, from a wider, more expansive place, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever seen a really great leader speak, and we all have, right? There's different, you know, if you've worked for someone like this, they're coming from a resource place where their intuition, their intuitive listening is high, where they oftentimes listen more than they speak, where they're enabling their team, where they're creating space for relationship and interaction, And that becomes the beauty of their job, not their spin. So when people are working with me, what we're trying to do is put them back in touch with that resourcing that happens from a very different place than the mind. It's usually happening from the body. Sometimes that might include looking at the stories that we all have about what performance looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And dismantling some of those stories. Those can come from childhood. Those can come from college. They certainly come from Stanford, right? So how do we dismantle some of that cognitive and neuro stuckness?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do we begin to teach the skills of staying down and in the body? Because the body is so infinitely intelligent that you don't have to work very hard for the body to just come up with the answer. It will just be there as if the flower is there for you to just pick it, and leadership becomes infinitely easier than when we're stuck in the spin.
Whew. I think we should just soak that in a little bit, because it is. You're talking about the flow state. When things happen, we don't even know how they happen. They just happen. And it's not when you're spinning and you're going, oh, we got to, it's like, let's just do, let's just be, and it'll
let's
come.
Let's just be.
And
that's right.
And
there's a whole lot underneath that, right? Because oftentimes confidence and imposter syndrome and all those, you know, tricky little tricksters, those will get in the way of us trusting that if we just stay with ourselves, the answers will be there, right? That flow state that you talk about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we'll need to work on confidence and trusting ourselves, and you know, those pieces come with it. But I fundamentally believe that the future leaders of this world at this time need to be operating from this place so we make good choices.
Yeah,
especially in the face of AI, right?
Like, yeah. This is it's definitely something that AI can't replicate.
But if it did, I would certainly want AI replicating from a space of vast aware knowing than a space of, you know, the mind, which is all ego that's tricking us into all sorts of nasty things, right?
Yeah. So yes. Okay. I'm coming back around here.
Were you prepared for this?
I was prepared for it, but not this. Okay, this is awesome, because you're going down a road that I think a lot of people are going to really relate to. They're going to feel it, because when you walk down the street, I don't care where you're going, and there are people on that street, I would guess that 90% of those people are in that spin mode. They are thinking about, they're, like you said, walking ahead of themselves. I don't care if they're 12, if they're 75. Because we just get conditioned to this, to where we can't. It's just like we forget that we can just live here and be here. Yes, you still work, you still do the things you do, but it's not out here in this spin where it's all getting your brain, your body, because when you're in that spin mode, your body is trying to kill itself basically from the stress you're
That's
inducing
right.
and everything else. And when you can bring that back out, you just feel so much better.
You feel better and you can do more.
Yeah.
I mean, my husband is constantly saying to me, like, how do you get it all done? And I'm like, you know, I just do whatever's in front of me. There it is. And I'm just I'm fully resourced to handle it. I don't have to work so hard. And you know what you said about 90%, probably 99% of the people out there, hopefully it's getting better.
Yeah.
But are it's spin to spin to spin to spin. And if you multiply that by the infinite number of interactions that are happening in a day, look at all that wasted energy. My gosh.
Yes. Yes. So you're helping these people, and they're getting they're figuring things out a little bit for themselves, and they're moving, they're taking themselves out of this spin. What are some of the things that they tell you about their personal lives once they kind of come out of the spin once in a while?
Well, without giving away confidentiality, I think that the themes that I hear most of all are usually there is some interruption that has happened somewhere along the way, or a stuck narrative, or two or three, that they are living from and the spin is controlling, or that is controlling the spin, right? So a stuck narrative, for example, might be, you know, I came from another country. I came to a really great school, not Stanford. This is a theme, but I came from it to a really great school. I've never had money. I don't feel like I belong here. I don't feel good enough. And P.S. I was abandoned by my dad when I was seven. You know, so you start to unpack, well, okay, we've got some deep narratives, right, around not feeling like you fit in, not feeling good enough, not feeling like you have the love that you needed. And so how do we, you know, what therapy does is it goes really down into the stories, and it spends most of its time down into the roots of a tree. What coaching does is it looks at that story, it owns that story, but then it grows up and forward, right? So you're looking at now, okay, knowing this, we're not going to go therapize. We're not going to spend six sessions therapizing about how you felt about your dad leaving. But what we are going to do is look at how that shaped a narrative that's interfering and connecting you into that spin.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to just dismantle it. We're going to get rid of it. And we might do practices, like I sometimes have people do a practice where they'll write on one side of a sheet of paper the narrative that the part of them that feels abandoned and not good enough and like an imposter feels. And then the other side, which is, what is it when you feel like you do belong and you're meant to be here and you can trust yourself fully? Right. And we'll work on that, and I'll use their language. So I'll use sort of like neurolinguistics to reprogram that every time they hit this trigger part of them, this old narrative, they can move into the new narrative, and the body begins to recognize that. The actual neurobiology changes, and the body will recognize that, right? And pull that into present time, and then that becomes the reality. It's really not hard. We just make it hard.
Yeah.
It's hard because our stories are stuck and there's pain, right? But when we can move through that and just own it and not be afraid of it and just say, okay, you know, every one of us usually has some story, whether it's big or small, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mine happened to be really, really big. You know, I had to move through a lot of them to get to the place that I feel like I am today, which is still highly imperfect, but a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you're going forward now, and I want to go back to, I've got lots of notes here because we were just having, I was having a lot of fun.
Me too.
Because one of the questions on your 18 month journey was, what is the nature of true love? What have you learned on that?
I don't know if this is going to be a very popular answer, but I'm going to give it to you. So what I learned, and I'm going to give you a little more context to the question. I was so fascinated by the fact that 60 to 70% of our movies, if not 80, have a love component in it, right? Where somebody can't find love and then they get love and they're searching for love and they lose love. 60 to 80% of our music, right, is about romantic love. I was sort of like all over the world, right? And like, what is this that people are really, really searching for? And I just didn't buy into the fact that it was really about romantic love. I thought that there's a different kind of thirst that's completely unquenched. And we've just gotten a little sidetracked by romantic love. It doesn't mean romantic love is not beautiful and that we shouldn't be in partnership. That's great. Mm-hmm. Whatever your partnership model looks like.
Whatever it looks like.
Whatever it looks like. So, okay. So I call romantic love the giant jester in the room. So, you know, the jester would come in front of the queen, and the jester would, you know, juggle balls and bounce around and hold a crown on his head or her head funny. It is a distraction. It's a distraction.
Oh, yeah.
It's a giant distraction from finding that place of limitless, timeless, ageless selfness. You're in love every day when you're there. You don't need anybody else to bring you. What love does is it brings us into present time, right? When we really, really either love or grief, they're two diametrically opposed emotions that bring us directly into contact with that embodied state that we leave, right? You can't just be out in spin land when someone in your life who's died, you know, like that grief overtakes you. Same thing with love. So like looking this hunger for love, because I think it brings us into this state of limitlessness, of timelessness, of like the world stops, right? Yeah. And then what happens 3, 4, 5 years? Like, maybe we need some kids because we need that feeling again. And maybe that's going to come from kids, or maybe it's going to come from a job change. But the truth is, it's already here. Mm-hmm. You do not have to do anything to find it. That was the answer. That was the honest answer I came up with.
Well, and
then eventually I did get married. But, you know, he's my partner. He's my partner. He doesn't have anything to do with my responsibility, is my own happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I think so many people look at the nature of love as outside of themselves. But really, you're talking about today, before this, now, through this. If you don't honestly know how to love yourself, I don't know how the heck you can really truly get to that point like you talk about, where it really, you just love, yes, your spouse, you love, yes, your friends, you love, yes, the world, you love, you know, because that's really, as you said, romantic love is the gesture.
It's the gesture.
That's kind of tricking us into this is what it is, but awesome stuff. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is, right? It's really fun. And you know, it's wonderful to hear you reflect it back. And I will say I'm working on a book, and I just want to tell you the name. I want to tell you
let's get into that just for a moment. Yeah.
So the name of the book is Complete. Ooh. Right. Yeah. And the concept is that we are enough in and of ourselves, that, you know, we can go out and we can chase all of the markers that we're told to chase, get a job, get a good job, find a spouse, have some kids. We can do all of those things. But to your point, if you never really learn to love yourself, if you are living in the spin and you're never coming into contact with who you are, the likelihood of dissatisfaction somewhere along the way is pretty high.
Yeah.
Right. And so the book is really about my journey. I call it a prescriptive memoir. There's little stories with little lessons that I learned along the way of how I found full completeness. And in fact, married myself when I was 51, and then 6 days later met my husband. Right. So I wouldn't have been able to really do this. And it was never in my head that I was doing this to meet him. But it did so happen that I don't think I could have had I not come full circle with myself.
Yes. Oh, that's awesome. That is so cool. Well, you know, Carrie, we are coming up to our end of the time today, and we are talking about putting your soul back into your work, and you talking about getting people out of the spin, helping them out of that. If someone wants to talk to you, what's the best way to get a hold of you, read more about what you do, anything like that?
Yeah, so the best way to find me is super easy. It is my name, Carrie Jacobs. So it's www.carriejacobs.com. If you go there, you can read more about what my clients have to say about my offerings. And I also offer a complimentary session, so you can get a free hour with me and we can hear what's going on for you. And then I also write a lot. So if you put my name in and you put Forbes or Entrepreneur Magazine, there are a lot of different articles that show up that I've written about different, you know, different angles and lenses into these topics.
Yes. And I apologize because we didn't talk about all that, because you are a well-published writer in many different.
That's okay.
But it's been such a pleasure having you here today, Carrie. I just thank you for stopping by and talking with us on the Faces of Business. And those of you that are listening, I just want to say, Yvonne, thanks for stopping by. You commented early. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for being here. And all the other listeners that are listening today and going to be listening as we go out onto YouTube again and podcasts and all that, go back to the beginning of this. Listen from the beginning. It's well worth your time to listen to what Carrie has to say about getting yourself out of the spin, really figuring out what's important in your life, and listen to her story. And then if it makes sense, reach out to her and learn more. Carrie, thank you for being here today.
Damon, what a lovely person you are. Thank you for doing what you do.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, everyone. Carrie, hang out for just a moment. We'll wrap up after we're off the air.
Sounds good.